Okay, I'm talking to Derek DeKirchhoff again, and we were just talking about some of Marsh McLuhan's colleagues, and Derek thought he'd like to get on the public record some details or his involvement with Ted Carpenter. Would you like to go into that, Derek?
Yeah, yes, because it was quite a story. So here I am in New York after having prepared my trip for at least 3 weeks ahead to interview four people.
Is that
John
for
Galkin,
the CBC in 1980,
yes.
81? I remember.
Yeah.
I have that, yes, yes.
So I'm to interview John Galkin, Tony Schwartz, Ted Carpenter, and Tom Wolfe.
Right.
I got an enthusiastic call through with, in fact, two of them, with Ted Carpenter. He's nice. He's enthusiastic. He lives in New York. He says, yes, come to my place and we'll have a nice talk. Good. So I go to New York. I meet Galkin. Galkin was lovely, really a nice man, really interested in McLuhan and very conscious of how McLuhan had helped his career and all that.
Yes.
Then I go to Tony Schwartz, go to his studio, kind of crowded. Tony talks about Tony. And very little about McLuhan, and in a kind of, well, you know, he was okay, but not, you know, McLuhan was Canadian, so he was definitely inferior, right? So Schwartz definitely was on top there.
Yeah.
Okay. I then call Ted Carpenter to say, well, I'm here. When? I have, you know, today and tomorrow. You said, I gave you the weekend. You said I should come in and call. And I came. Oh, yeah, he said. Oh, well, you know. Oh, well, you can forget that. I said, what? Yeah, you can forget that because, you know, I don't really want to talk about McLuhan. Oh, I said, what? You know, you assured me just a few weeks ago that I was welcome, and now I've come specially for that. Well, no, I'm sorry. You know, I don't want to talk about McLuhan.
Wow.
Hey, okay. But why is that? Oh, well, this guy, you know, I mean, they don't talk about McLuhan. But in fact, McLuhan, he took all my ideas. It's everything is in McLuhan. It's straight from what I wrote. We did it together. We were in exploration together. It's all my stuff. It's my stuff. He's taken my stuff. And he goes on like this, and you know what? We spend, I calculated because I was calculating my time, we spent 50 minutes on the phone, him constantly saying extraordinarily mean things about McLuhan.
Wow, that's 5-0 minutes or 1-5 minutes?
No, 5-0.
Wow.
50 minutes. In
wow.
fact, he loved talking because every time we had three conversations, two in Toronto, from Toronto, and two once I was in New York. And the two Toronto ones were 40 or 50 minutes each, and the one in New York was the same. But it was a continuous rambling of anger.
Yeah. Now,
very strange.
Well, I've first
well,
of all,
let
this
me tell
was
you the story.
This was after Marshall died, right?
Well, yeah, of course.
Yeah,
quite,
and it's just a few months after, you know. You got that documentary out pretty quickly, I remember.
Yes, because it was, wait a minute. No, absolutely not. No, it wasn't.
Yeah, I think in my mind you did it just before Marshall died. It was before Marshall
died. That's right.
In the fall of 1980.
Yeah, but Marshall was sick already.
Yes, that's right. He was out of action, and you decided to put
and,
it on record.
And not only, no, here we go. This is what's going to hit you, is that I go to the funeral march of Marshall, and who's giving the eulogy but Mr. Ted Carpenter, who certainly said a whole lot of different things then that he had said to me. Anyway, the story in New York continues. And for the 3 weeks before, I had not been able to get in touch with either the agent or with Tom Wolfe himself, and he was the most important person I wanted to interview. Anyway, after this this really sad conversation with Carpenter, I go back to the Mayfair Hotel where I had taken a room, and I had planned to go out next door to the Metropolitan Opera. I was so dismayed, so disappointed, so down, I let it go, and I fell asleep, and I slept till 9 or 10 in the next day. I had nobody else to see, but I'm not one to lose hope.
Yeah.
I went across the park. I knew the address of Tom Wolfe. I went across the park, knocked on the door of Tom Wolfe's house, a nice lady who obviously was a maid working in the house said, well, Mr. Wolf is busy right now, but maybe I can ask him when he can see you. So she goes up, the Wolf comes down, says, yes, I am. I'm very glad you're here. I was really fond of Marshall, and I'm delighted to give an interview about him, but I can't do it now. Come back at 4. Mm. And we have the most wonderful interview with Tom Wolf. So I came back with 3 documents, 2 of which were really very nice about Marshall, and nothing from Ted Carpenter. So that's my story there. So
let me supplement that. I talked to Ted. I was living in New York City from 1993 till 2008, and I spent a few years talking to him in 1994, 1995, and 1996. We had a lot of talks, but he was always expressing disappointment at what happened to Marshall. And if you recall, he did this article for Robert Fulford in 1992 or so, and then Don Thiel has it as an appendix at the back of Don's book, which comes out in 2001 or so. You know, mm-hmm. It's called The Virtual Marshall McLuhan. And he talks about the great, exciting person that Marshall was in the early years of the 50s. And then he talks about how he witnessed the exploitation of Howard Gossage of McLuhan. And he says,
yes,
McLuhan
he told me that as well.
Right.
And he was very bitter towards Marshall,
that's
not
right.
towards Howard. And then he also said that Marshall had been incredibly diminished after his stroke.
And that's not true. We know that.
Among the things he said, I'm telling you, in 50 minutes he had a chance to say a lot of stuff, and I wasn't recording anything because, you know, I didn't get
yes.
the permission.
Yes.
And so, anyway, just to say, there's nothing much to it except that I wanted to be on the record because it was a disastrous day for me. It was very unfair, and it certainly revealed one side of the relationship between Marshall and his so-called colleagues that wasn't pinky or rosy, altogether.
Yeah.
Mind you, Marshall himself was not tender about his associates, colleagues, students. I mean, Marshall wasn't tender about anybody, including himself.
That's right. But let me just finish. So in this article, he talks about Marshall basically was kaput after his illness in 1960. He tells the story that Marshall said he had finished, he had done the work of God, and that he wanted to die, and he was upset that he survived. That's 1960. And so then you have Marshall becomes famous because the Gossage and these people manipulate the media, and Carpenter witnesses this, and then Marshall's not competent to do certain articles and tasks in 66, 67 because of the malignant tumors coming on. And then Ted says mm-hmm. that he... he writes this article for Harper's Bazaar. He had to do it on a last weekend, and he does that, and then that later becomes They Became What They Beheld. But he's saying that Marshall's downhill from 1960, 62, and he helped him get through he helped do Understanding Media. There's lots of parts of Understanding Media in there. Now, that may be true, but the thing is Marshall's very busy and doing all this other stuff anyways, speaking all over the world. And
I am not saying one thing one way or the other. Marshall once told me.
No, but I'm backing up what you're saying. Let me just finish.
No, I know. I'm just saying. Yeah.
He goes on, and he says that after Marshall's stroke, the brain surgery, Marshall is a basket case, and he says that he compares him to Muhammad Ali. And says, I saw Muhammad Ali in his prime, and then I saw him later with the Parkinson's or whatever it was he got. And he says the same thing happened to Marshall. Now, you and I were with Marshall in the 70s, and he wasn't, incapacitated in any ways. He was functioning pretty strong and making new ideas. He didn't have as much opportunity. He wasn't speaking as much on the main stage, but he was speaking all over the world anyways, other places.
Oh, yeah.
Not always.
I went with him to some of those.
Yeah. And so at the end, he talks about the funeral and how he writes this all in Fulford's article, and you can read it in Don Thiel's book. He talks about he and Tom Estabrook and a couple other guys, the old guard, complained about the McLuhan children and how they had kept Marshall away from Ted and Tom Estabrook. So he ends on a real down, depressed note about Marshall at the end of that article. And then when I talked to him a few years later, he's continues saying the kind of stuff that he said to you. He was saying that all the time. He was very bitter, and I think that he missed the boat. He said that he did not like the way Marshall went into media as a global thermostat, using computers to modulate, you know, big environments. He said, I appreciated Marshall back when he was in his aesthetic phase in the early 50s. The aesthetics is what Ted Carpenter was involved with. And Ted gets into the art world, the very world that Marshall made fun of. And so Carpenter stayed with the aesthetics world and got involved with Dia, and his wife was part of the Demoniel family, which were, you know, real controllers or influential gatekeepers in the art world, you know, and that's still a controversy, the foundation with the Demoniels.
Yeah, she had an estate, his wife. She was rich.
Oh, yeah, well, his wife was the daughter of the Demoniels that created Andy Warhol. They created all the major artists of the 60s and 70s.
Oh, yeah, so that was big time.
Yeah, so they're a major institute. It's called DIA. DIA. And anyways, Ted ended up in the art establishment world that Marshall satirized and had tremendous things to say about the art world and how to. He had a new theory of art, how to look at it in its history, and Ted was not interested in that and not interested in the global programming that Marshall did as an art form. So that's why we're talking about Barry Nevitt, because Barry went on to do the later part, what I call the later McLuhan, and that's what we're reading. Is there anything else you want to say about Ted before we do Barry?
No. No.
Yeah, let's
the reason I wanted to say this was because I think it should be known, and I do remember a quote from Eliot. I think that Marshall said that something to do that no sooner you're gone and dead that your best friends stop trampling on your body.
That's from Eliot?
Something like that. But no, I can't remember the real quote, but there is one where one of his quotes in the card game is, "Don't when you're down and out, don't raise your head because your friends will knock your teeth in." You remember that one?
Not really. I don't remember that. Don't recall that.
No, but this one is more serious. And I think it is either Joyce or Eliot that says that you're a hero before you die, and then the moment you're dead, you're in the gutter or something
right.
Anyway, that's too long on that one. No, I was fascinated by the futurism business because about the futurism past.
By
which
Barry
Nevitt.
We're talking about Barrington Nevitt.
So to regurgitate package future that replay the past as popular substitute for understanding the present, which is the only future for the future, and thus becomes self-fulfilling, I am interested in that idea about future, past, and present. I was at a conference the other day, well, in fact, it was 2 days ago in Milan, and there was an artist from the ZKM, which is a very nice and very, very, you know, influential art and technology center in near Stuttgart in Germany. And this guy said, he was talking about the issue of time, and he said some totally fascinating things, but he said, one other thing for sure, there is no future. No, there is no future. So everybody sort of, you know, oh, wait a minute, all these young people in front were kind of upset. Thought he was talking about terrorism or what is it? No, there's no future. There never has been a future. And there's less future now than ever. I live in the present. And that reminded me, of course, of Marshall saying, you know, the artist is the only one who can understand the future because it's in the present. The only one who lives in the present.
Right.
And so...
Well, remember McLuhan liked to say, the future of the future is the present. And that's what this guy's saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was saying this with absolute authority, and he was extremely interesting. He said all kinds... He also said real time doesn't exist. And so he said, oh, there's no space, there's only time, but real time doesn't exist. And I made an objection. I said, wait a minute, there is such a thing as real time, which is the time it takes for a machine to respond to your command. That's the technical term. And he said, yes, that does exist. But when you think about time, there is no real time. It never stops. It's constantly changing. And there is only time. There is no space, because all the space that I occupy is the space of my mind. Whatever shape or whatever substance behind it is, the dominant feature of that space is my mental approach to it or my understanding of it. So there is no space, virtual, real, whatever. So I thought that was like very interesting stuff, because right now I'm really working on the geometry or the anatomy, I would say, of search engines. I'm very interested in how does one, you know, what is a search engine and how does it work? I'm fascinated by, you know, page ranking. I'm fascinated by the different kind of vertical and horizontal axis of meaning, association, hierarchical. These things are all structured, and they are structured also in our keyword search engines. And so one of the things which is really very interesting about this issue of future and present is that a search engine not only depends on the things I've just said and on page ranking and on giving priority to, you know, the number of people who have been interested in the answer you're looking for, but there is also the issue of cookies. Cookies are actually, as you know, a little messenger, little RNA in the computer that locates you and locates the site that tells the site that you want right away that it's you and that you don't have to go through all the, you know, rigmarole of having to rewrite your name and request it. So the cookie is there to basically facilitate and accelerate your navigation online. But what happens, of course, is the cookies are the prime material for, you know, capitalizing, personalizing ourselves online, so that capitalizing on the number of things we're looking for. That's a way to trace us online and on the Internet, and hence constitute a profile or something very strong. Now, what does that profile do? It serves both government and business to actually serve your needs according to who you are and how you are. And so it is useful on one hand, useful for security, useful for health, useful for, indeed, matching your desires. But it's much more powerful than the old, you know, publicity stint, which was, you know, give the public what they want. No, give the person what she wants. And make sure that you know that person, and that person is known. So what is now seen is the preemptive quality, hence building a future from the present, pushing you in the direction that looks like you, creating the world as your mirror as opposed to simply letting your face go into a mirror. So I find it fascinating, the issue of time. Yes, all times are now, as Marshall said, but they're now in a very strange new way right now that I don't know that Marshall had in mind, or Barry for that matter. What do you think?
I go with the notion that there's not even any now.
Very unfortunate. What are we doing now, for example?
No.
That's really unfortunate. I thought we were having a conversation, Bob.
No, it's being recorded. And there's no way...
I know, so it's not real. Of course, I'm sorry, I forgot.
No, it's something like this. You can't establish when it happened because there's no reference point in the virtual reality we're in, the Matrix, the Android meme. You can't determine a beginning and you can't determine an ending. What people have yearned for in their physical bodies have immortality. We have here. And it's partly, as McLuhan said, weightlessness leads to immortality. And there's no weight in this situation. And everything is being recorded and re-recorded. Remember, he said the instant replay was the biggest metaphysical mind fuck that ever would happen to people. So I think I don't think there's a past, present, or future, and the future is the present. That's nostalgia for the idea that there is a present. I say there is no present because you cannot establish when it is. If you look at how everything is being recorded and replayed and adjusted, and nobody and everybody's in that chaos, and if you're totally accurate about it, you couldn't determine where we began, where we left. So that's how I get. So I say there's no space and there's no time. McLuhan used to say that. But I think that the fact that we've been superseded by the environments, which are pretending to make it more guide and more geared to you and make you feel that you're in control and in power and all this stuff, I think that's a Gnostic illusion. I think it's an illusion, and we live a Gnostic world like, you know, Eric Davis wrote a book on technosis, the Gnostic vision, but I wouldn't even say any description exists in the present. And that's what I think Baudrillard was trying to say. Don't you think Baudrillard, in discussing the ideal nothingness that we were living in, was trying to show that there wasn't even a present?
Well, that's all very unfortunate.
No, it isn't. We don't need the idea of where we are. You are here anyways, and you don't even need a mind about this. The traditional role of the mind is to gauge, you know, coordinates, and the mind has no function today.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way.
What do you think of the theory of Roy Ascott and others who say that the mind is all out there, but that our brain is not producing it? It's simply like eyes for sights. Our brain works on whatever mind's available.
Yeah, I would say it's automatic. It's autonomic, and it's not really having any input other than responding to the flow of the blood. That thought comes out of the circulation of the blood. Now, that's a very obscure thing for me to say, and that's another area of thinking that I don't think it applies to this situation. But I'm just telling you, I can do some different kind of talk on it, but I want to stay within the McLuhan-Barry-Nevitt thing, and within that, I'm saying there's no now.
Well, I think this is very, very bad news.
No, it isn't. No, okay, no, Derek, that's the point. You're now that you know, you're still here or nowhere, but you have to play with the idea of communication, of connecting with people. That's my theory that why everybody's so fanatically texting all the time is that they intuit that there's no now anymore. And so there's a panic in the population to see if anybody's out there to confirm that they exist. That's why the digital texting environment makes people obsessive about it, because they are trying to connect. And it's interesting, in Ted Carpenter's They Became What They Beheld, the first item is called Only Connect. Well, that's turned into an environmental hazard now. People don't understand that they cannot establish who they are or any time and space, and therefore they're panic connecting all the time. So his statement is only for analog media, not the digital world. So if you take
I had a metaphor rather than a theory about where it's at regarding connecting, is that kids particularly put themselves online in every which way with their, photographs and best films and thoughts and tweets and whatnot.
Mm.
They spread themselves online as much they can in order to have some kind of positions, even weight, even substance. They replace substance, in fact, with spread, because what we used to have was substance of the strong, private, opaque, closed-in identity, consciousness, and all that.
Yeah.
Kids today print themselves out, or rather publish themselves online in every which way, in order to have a sense of being.
That's right. But all they can arrive at is diaphanous. You know, the famous...
Yeah, they are diaphanous.
They're diaphanous. And they are trying to just see if there's anything to connect with. And to complain that they aren't very social, they can't talk in the chemical body, in the physical body, they can't communicate properly, don't have any constancy within it, that's not to recognize the dire situation we're in from that perspective, and that they're bravely holding the fort together by trying to connect to people or to connect to other diaphanous substances, you know.
We agree.
Yeah, the adults have been very responsible in creating these environments. Even Marshall used to talk about it, that, you know, the kids are suffering in schools, and he sees it in his college classes, and they're suffering due to environments created by their parents. There's the huge irresponsibility of the last 50 years, you know, and here's everybody making these digital environments here, and the kids, where they can't even get born. They can't even establish where they were. And are, so.
But okay, all right, and it's all fine, and it's true. On the other hand, they're also metamorphosing. They're also changing. And the change is maybe not very visible, but it has to be at least as drastic as the change between the medieval man and the Renaissance man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This change from the analog to the digital, I like what Arthur Croker said, you know, back in the 90s. He said that our genes were using us to get to the machines, and they've leaped out of our bodies and entered into the living technology, what I call the android meme. The genes have left the bodies. Now, he was being very extreme. Now, that's not a despondent situation. It's just that our models that science offers and what they teach in med school aren't even near what where we are. And that's why I say my five-body model would be more appropriate to teach than anything that any Western knowledge systems are applying. That's how extreme it is. And so the kids are swimming, as Eric ends Laws of Media, with an unchartable and uncharted sea. That's the last line of Laws of Media. We can't chart.
Say, just a bit on the five bodies. Wasn't John O'Neill interested in five bodies?
No, but
he actually used.
No, his was limited. I have his books, and he was up there in New York. He doesn't perceive what I'm talking about. He kept it still almost, it was just theosophical. So I was not impressed with his model. He came up with that a long time ago. But
I know, but I mean, why were there five? I can't remember what they were.
Oh, well, the physical body is what people think they're born into. And here's this given body. And I call that the chemical body because it's the Western biological, neurological, scientific, genetic model that's imposed on people's physicalness, and that's the model for people. So I call that the chemical body. That's their physical body. Then there's the idea many cultures have that there's more than the physical body. So I call that the astral body, and that's the reservoir of literature and oral traditions and shamanism and spirituality and experiences that shows there's more than the chemical Western model. Then there's the...
And myth is in there.
Myth?
Myth is also in your astral body.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Now, the third point is that the television environment or landscape in the 50s, 60s, 70s has been shrunk by the digital media so that the shrinking of the huge landscape where people now have the TV body in their fingertips or the TV landscape, that becomes a body, a little barnacle attached to the physical and astral. And then the chip environment, that shrunk over the last 15 years, so that's on the level of a chip body. So you got four bodies there. You got the TV simulates the physical chemical because people use the TV to sit back, relax, and receive and consume. Whereas the chip body is like the astral body. You go and explore, and you create spaces more than you do in your consumer phase of the TV body. So the TV body is always being phased out, but it's still there because people like to relax and stop probing, which they're forced to do daily in the chip body. So you get those four bodies. Then I say there's another landscape that we know nothing about that is more than we know, and I just assume we're going to discover more of that. It's what we don't know yet. And, you know, that may be what Ray Kurzweil tries to describe with the spiritualized machines. It's just new things, new environments that we haven't seen. Well, when Ion came along, I realized that was the mystery landscape, and he was describing, Ion, describing the mystery landscape. And the more we understand it, which we've learned the last 5 years from Ion, we now have a fifth body. The mystery body is getting known. So those are the five bodies that I work with, the unknown landscape that's dominating more like just the phenomenon of sinkholes. What are sinkholes? And Ion explains what they are. They're part of what people didn't know. And so therefore we can include sinkholes in the mystery landscape, and therefore knowing it is part of the mystery body. So those are my five terms, and we're moving towards the hexadic body, which is the extension of non-physical. You know, both the analog media history that McLuhan laid out, that's physical. Then when the android meme extends just itself, which we've been inside of for the last 30 years, that is a second level of the physical. Now, that's run its course. What is the next thing to be extended? The non-physical, and that's what Ion is. But I don't like to bring in Ion into this conversation unless you're open to it but I don't want to go into it. But that's how I got the Hex Attic Body, is the extensions of non-physical, which is our product and our Coldplay technology. If you knew what this battery is made up of, you'd realize it's way beyond any of our scientific and technical knowledge. It's just unbelievable what we use. We do have a public statement. We use our fingernails. We use fingernails at the heart of this machine. Now, why fingernails? Well, Ion says the fingernails, they don't die when people, they're cast off clay, so to speak, when they transition, when the body stops functioning. The hair and the fingernails keep going. Well, there's some strange force in the fingernails, and we use that in our machine. So that's a side thing. Let's go into at least the five bodies I'm talking about.
Yeah, but what do you do? What does your machine drive around, or what do you
do? It works. It works. It's very, very powerful. And we are figuring...
Yeah, but I mean, what is it? What does it concretely do? Does it cook you your eggs, or does
No. It makes endless electricity.
Oh, it does. Power. Do you use it at home?
Yes, you would use it at home, yeah. It would be...
But are you using it at your home?
I said last time, no comment. I want to have a little...
There you are, Foxy. Yeah. Listen.
No, it's practical. It's practical, Derek. We're going to release it properly, and I can't say I have it here. Everybody in the world will be at my doorstep banging here trying to see it. You know what I mean?
But that's what I'm doing. I'm being at your doorsteps, and I'm banging to find out more.
Well, I'm not... since there's no now, now you see why I have to say there's no now, Derek. No, you're not going to say... Are you going to say you got to go now?
No.
Good. I thought
not right away, but yes. This battery is only, you know, 1/5 charged, so it'll go before.
Okay.
But anyway, not to worry. No, what I was going to say is I wanted to get back to the prophecy side.
Yes.
Not that we're finished with futurism, but in any case,
let me just say, read. We didn't read it. We just jumped in. Here's what Barry says about futurism. In that meme, we would regurgitate packaged futures that replay the past as popular substitutes for understanding the present, which is the only future for the future, the present. So he's put in the future of the present. That's in the statement, and thus becomes self-fulfilling. I would say that's not adequate compared to what I was trying to say. There's no present. But it is not bad, and Ted Carpenter would have done well to study that and not argue about whether he was stolen by Mark. Barry didn't steal that from Ted Carpenter, right? And that's based on a dialogue with Marshall in the 70s.
What about the prophecy then?
It says to pre-play, not replay, to pre-play alternate fate. What I liked about Take Today, that book, they talk about evitable fate, not inevitable. They use the phrase evitable fate. I don't think anybody ever said that. To pre-play alternate fate, which circumvents technical grounds and digital figures alike, to make the effects precede the causes through human harmonies of rhythm, rhyme, reason, and silence, and thus become self-negating. Now, that's pretty good. That's making prophecy... in a new dimension, it's almost, how do you make prophecy if there's no now, right? You pre-play, you only get a present by pre-playing a scenario of past, present, future. Mm-hmm. You can't get...
No, that's true. It's a very strong point.
Yes.
And but what I'm interested in is the presence of the word digital at a time when clearly nobody was talking about digital.
That's right. It's very – he writes this in 1979, 1980. So it circumvents technical grounds and digital figures alike. I would say that points to the extension of the non-physical. It's alternate fate. And you pre-play it. See, he is really intuiting there's no now. I mean, how would you say that?
Yeah, but I mean, my question is, I made a discovery, by the way, that search engines don't use meaning anymore. They don't need it. They bypass it completely. So I just wanted to know from, because you have a keyword trained mind, do you know many other circumstances or writings where digital is used as a word in Marshall or in Barry?
I don't think so. I mean, anybody else or in themselves? You mean in what they wrote?
No, I mean, digital figures, you know, we know technical grounds, the meaning is a message. Digital figures, that's a huge jump.
Yeah.
Marshall only writes about computers at the end of Understanding Media, the Timid Giant.
Right.
He rarely talks about computer. He does, of course, in the book with the prophecy, or rather the Ten Commandments that put us together, if you can remember.
Yes. No, he wrote
by
he
mistake
writes,
about where that
about
came from.
He talks about computers with Bruce Powers in The Global Village.
He does, but yeah. I mean, you know, that's not. They don't really go digital.
No.
Digital really doesn't come into fashion until, you know, much later.
That's right.
As a word.
No, I mean, this is incredible. This is Barry is the sleeper here. He's way ahead of everybody in saying digital, and he's calling them figures, which is incredible.
Well, on top, that's what I'm saying. He uses ground figure, and the fact that there is a technical ground, which would be here electricity, and it's digital figures. Well, you know, that's cool. And then, of course, I've always liked the effects preceding the cause, but I've never understood it other than for the artist. Nevermore. The effects that you want to have on your audience makes you paint impressionism. And again, you can create expectation by music. So let's just say the human harmonies of rhythm, yep, you can expect things from rhythm. Rhyme, of course, you would expect. Reason, you know the continuity. And silence. I like the word silence here. It's very interesting.
Yes.
How silence helps the effects to precede the cause.
Well, in Barry's other writings, he talks about the rhythm addicts, the rhyme addicts, that's hip-hop, and then the reason addicts. And then he brings in silence. That would be tactility. Tactility is the not knowable part, but he includes that as part of the ratios here. Human harmonies, rhythm, rhyme, reason, and silence. I mean, it's incredible what Barry's actually done here, and that is to elaborate the effects preceding the causes. You know some of these examples of that. You know, for example, Surratt's pointillism anticipates TV by, you know, 50 years.
Again, it's art. It's art.
Art anticipates it. Now, let's see if we can come up with a better or a newer thing. The effects precede the causes. That would be the confusion of past, present, future. That would involve with the future is the present. That would involve there's no now. The effects precede the causes is an attempt to show that any rational projection of duration is not appropriate to what's happening here when you're pre-playing alternate fate.
You're right.
Yeah, you know, Barry is trying to describe what can't be described, and he does it as a scientist. He's talking technically. He has a certain limited vocabulary, and he works within that.
Well, he's also, I would say, he has a good literate or literary, and even almost poetic, I would say bend here.
Yeah,
because he ends the futurism by, and thus becomes self-fulfilling, and invites us to go back to the futurism from the prophecy, because he says ends up being self-negating. So, no, it's nice. I mean, the balance is important, because both statements belong to considerations about the future, but one is from the point of view of, in fact,
there's no
futurism.
Future. There's no
could,
future.
Well, no, but it could also be a connotation, at least with Italian futurist.
Yes.
And with and then prophecy is then is rather the future seen, the future said, as I said, pre-played, the future presented, as opposed to the future hoped for or the future happening, or you know, futurism
the
and
future
prophecy
already
have different
here.
Biases.
It's already
That's
here.
Right.
It's already here when he says effects precede causes. So, you know, it's interesting. Now we take this complexity of the last two points, of futures and prophecy. Let's go back until your phone runs out, and let's redo generalism. Let's see what he's really doing here, because it's going to be more complicated, because we've seen the punchline, futurism and prophecy. So he says in generalism, to multiply technical specialisms that proliferate the fallacies of misplaced concrete, both hardware and software, as profitable substitutes for comprehensive awareness. Now, isn't that incredible? It's not even what you want, which is comprehensive awareness. He's talking about providing substitutes that anticipates not merely the material, but all the other consequences of major change. Boy, that is even more profound in light of what I just learned in the prophecy. You know, he is really trying to describe what no one has really laid out, you know, in sociological ways. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, I'm still trying to twist my mind around this. To multiply technical specialism that proliferate the fallacies of misplaced concrete. I didn't realize proliferate was transitive. So, but that's okay. I'll let it go.
Specialisms are an illusion, but we use them to multiply specialisms to enhance misplaced concrete. It's Baudrillardian. We can use anything. Marshall said he would use anything to write his books. He'd grab this fact, that statement, that myth. You know, he just throw a mishmash into the
pot. He said bad artists steal, bad artists borrow, the big ones steal.
Yes, yeah. Then both hardware and software as profitable substitutes for comprehensive awareness. In other words, generalism is trying to give the big picture. McLuhan said that the elites are the ones who interpret the big patterns of data proliferation, the big...
Yeah, no, you know, they hated specialism, both.
Right, but he says the elites... The Kissingers, they hijacked the interpretation of the big trends, the big patterns, and he didn't think that they were adequate in that. So here's what Barry's saying, that you're doing substitutes for comprehensive awareness when you're making generalisms that anticipate not merely the material but all the other consequences of major change. Barry says it's not multiple specialisms that is comprehensive awareness. He says it's multiple... sensory dynamics. In other words, an encyclopedic in conceptual details, like knowing a lot about all these different subjects, is not comprehensive awareness. Comprehensive awareness knows about different sensory profiles and how each media alters the cultural sensory profiles. It's not in the world of concept. And that's important. That's comprehensive awareness. So he's saying generalism is a conceptual thing, can only lead to specialisms, and he's showing how it's fallacious. He's showing that it's not comprehensive awareness, but you play with it in a great complexity so that you anticipate not merely the material but other consequences of major change. So that is a very complex statement dealing with the conceptual. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's stepping aside and letting the conceptual have its day and ready to cancel it with the perceptual, with the comprehensive awareness.
No, I don't find it that difficult. I mean, it's the basic of it is the comprehensive awareness, and it describes it very well. That's clear. That anticipates not merely the material, but all the other consequences of major change, and that's exactly what's missing still today among most of the commentators about a digital culture.
Right, but he's...
They don't get it. I mean, most people don't realize, very rarely do you find somebody who gives you an idea that perhaps we are in a civilizational change.
Well,
they all think we're in technical...
No,
they think we're in a technological change.
Yeah, everybody has some paradigm. They all acknowledge the paradigm shift and this and that, but they don't understand the implications of it, and that's where Croker, you know, exaggerates it to make you say, no, the change is way beyond what you think is being changed, and I'm indicating it by saying that, non-physical is here being extended, and on top of that, there's no now. I mean, there's no
Yeah,
future.
But you see, this is what I'm reading and understanding in comprehensive awareness.
No, but this is not comprehensive awareness. This is profitable substitutes.
I know. That's the specializations.
Yes, they are.
They are profitable substitute. Why? Because no, but misplaced concrete. The misplaced concrete are the actual benefits of specializing.
Yeah,
and those benefits are actually, they are economies. He says both hardware and software as profitable substitutes. Like, you know, basically you're so busy doing those things and living off those things and going on, you know, Google and other places. These are profitable substitutes for much deeper understanding of where we are, what we're doing, and what the, you know.
Yeah, no, the wealth, ignorance makes wealth. Rear-view mirrorism makes wealth, and most people are engaged in that.
Right.
And if we understand that we're living beyond our perception, then you are more tolerant about how everybody seems super conservative about their particular fetishes. You know, that's a natural way to create wealth while we adapt to the fact that we are not here anymore. You know, that's the major change. We're in a new dimension that no images apply. So look at the last sentence of Laws of Media. We're in an unchartable sea. It can't be charted, and it's uncharted. You know, it's unchartable, and it can't be charted. I mean, that's the mystery of the landscape right there in the end of...
It's not even very charitable.
Yeah. Yeah. What, it's two aspects. It's uncharted and not chartable. I mean, in other words, they write a book about the laws of media and these four laws, and then they end saying, well, you know, basically, we're sorry we had you study these patterns because you can't apply them. We're in an uncharitable situation. That's how the book ends.
Damn, miserable.
That's me.
Again, very unfortunate.
That's me. The Frenchman, the Belgian, the European. You still have hope, don't you? You still look at.
Oh yeah. No. I'm full of it.
Okay. Let's go to science. Now back to science.
Yep.
To organize ignorance for deliberate discovery. That means you already know what the range is of a discovery you could make, and it would be. It would be fallacious because it's within known. It's you're attempting to chart by recognizing new process patterns through fresh percepts to harmonize knowledge for rapid access by reorganizing the old ground rules with new concepts. So use new percepts and new concepts, using both, to escape tunnel vision through second sight for perceiving the complementarity of art and science for matching and making and restore the ancient unity of thought and feeling.
At that time, you know, Marshall would just stop and say, I need a rest.
Yeah. And,
that's more twisted.
Yeah, and Bob Logan would say, I don't know, Barry, that seems a little extreme.
ever the gracious man.
Yes, the professor. Okay, then you got communication. So there's a major theme, communication. What does Barry say about that? To anticipate all the main effects of everything natural. In other words, you say you must enter the world knowing everything. That's what he's saying. You anticipate all the main effects of everything natural and artificial, sacred and profane, dead and alive, on every other living body at itself. That's quite a...
Well, you know that. At the same, about the same time, no, a bit earlier, Eugène Ionesco had invented the doctorat total. The complete doctorate.
And he presented that in a play?
Yep. He actually said in La Leçon, it's called The Lesson, that a little young woman coming to get a private lesson from a professor who vows to teach her everything and then, of course, ends up devouring her or something like that. I can't remember how it ends, but it's not well.
So Barry thinks he's going to run it up the flagpole. He's going to say, he's going to try pull it off. And he's going to do it by harmonizing programs with their media in order to share intended experience with living beings involved in this communication ecology. I think Barry is trying to show with this excess verbiage about how complex everything is, and nobody's even attached. That's like you saying, not even dealing with the huge change that's happening. You know, they're being timid.
Yeah.
They're keeping you within known areas of concepts. And then you also have to perceive that such communication is revolution by conversion, both inner and outer, and to leave communication between machines to engineers and scientists. So let them build these machines that are obsolete the day they get out, because the effects have already been anticipated if you're aware of everything. See, these are ridiculous statements for a normal, practical person, right? But they are necessary, because he's trying to go past what anybody ever said. You know, he's really trying to be the most generalist general.
Sure, it's a bit Finnegan's Wakey.
That's right. It's Finnegan's Wakey in English. He reduces it to one language. He's not dealing with verbal modules. That's what McLuhan said Joyce was obsessed with, verbal modules. These are post-verbal environmental modules he's talking about. Like to harmonize programs with their media in order to share intended experience with living beings involved in this communication ecology. It's already balanced. To perceive that such communication, you can let the tinkerers make new little machines, they're not going to affect the communication ecology, because everything that could be done has already happened. That's another thing Marshall said. Everything has already happened. Anything that you could imagine could be done has already happened in the implications of the present. I found this quote where Marshall says that when radio came in, we evolved, mutated a million years in a few seconds. Now, look at that. When you bring in the electric environment, that's like Teilhard de Chardin's electricity is a biological event. If you actually look at it, the Darwinian natural scenario of nature That evolution is long gone. So what's mutating us is the technologies, and the technologies are changing so rapidly that he said we went a million years in a few seconds. Now, that's trying to show people it's way bigger than the images you're using. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're trying
yeah.
to show.
And I used to compare that to the precipitation that makes the egg and the sperm actually come together and start a life, because there is, according to medieval and also Thomist theory, there is a moment between before and after, a real before and after, between the time of the gestation beginning but it taking hold at some point. And I think they discussed this around when does a person become a person. Maybe already worried about abortion. I'm not quite sure. But anyways, in St. Thomas, there is this idea of precipitation, and I think that corresponds to what Marshall is saying about radio.
Well, that's wonderful you said that, because guess what Ion says when pregnancy begins? Because you have, you know, primitive people, they had very interesting ideas about what was going on in pregnancy, and then we have our technical biological model. But Ion says pregnancy begins at arousal. That sounds like what you were trying to say. That's effects preceding causes. It's already happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you say pregnancy begins with arousal.
Brilliant.
So you actually said something that backs up what Ion said. You know what I mean? That's pretty good.
Well, I'm very glad. The situation is improving.
Okay. So we've done communication and then education. To learn the old disciplines as art forms inside academic walls while exploring the new problems outside where the action is. To shift stress from conceptual to perceptual training, where bull sessions retrieve dialogue and lectures become entertainment. I get from that what Marshall used to say is everybody should stay home. There's nothing to go to. You're already receiving what's happening in your environment, and it's beyond what you can conceive. If you just notice it and you just stay home and don't make a move. That's what I get from Barry's educational thing, because he's saying let the art forms carry on in their academic halls, you know, and let the real action happen outside, or the complementary action. And but I think that's a timid statement compared to the later statements, right?
I think so.
You know, actually, we could look at economics, management, and education and politics. The first five or so are easy. And then he goes into the, it's Ulysses, the first five, and the second five are Finnegan's Wake. Ulysses is easy to read once you're familiar with Finnegan's Wake. So there's something, so that's interesting. So you get the five levels of rhetoric. I wonder if there's the five parts of rhetoric in here, you know, done twice.
Mm-hmm.
So just an idea. I'm not going to dwell on it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's basically the first would have to be inventio.
Wouldn't that be?
And so that would be politics. But I don't see why it would start with politics.
Well, because a new environment is political. That is what all battles. Politics is controlling who's in charge of the most powerful weaponry. Who's got the power?
Mm.
And so if you're making a new technology. Then you've become political at the rawest level. And then that affects the economy, which affects management, which then changes education for what you're going to tell the next generation. And all of it is communication. So I can start to work out a pattern there if we accept politics as inventio. Economics would be dispositio. Management would be...
I guess.
What?
No, I guess. I wouldn't force it, because I am very much aware, and I've used it a lot, the five parts of rhetoric, and although I know they are all simultaneous, there is an order to them, and they don't come in ten, they come in five.
No, that's what I mean. There's two fives here.
It would be easier to use the Ten Commandments and make the five parts of rhetoric.
No, I'm saying that there's the analog version of the five parts, and then the digital squaring of it by the Android meme, where it replays itself. and it's not involved with the analog world. So that's why I'm saying there's two fives. I'm not saying there's ten. But yes, Barry is, the ten is implied here. These are Ten Commandments. That's what he's including here. He's making Ten Commandments. And the so if you go back to politics, which we did a bit at the beginning many months ago, politics, to hide behind 19th century planks while seeking 20th century electronic images to put on new publics. Now, you would do both. And that's the tetrad. The intelligence agencies operate on the level of enhancing, obsolescing, retrieving, and flipping into. They know all four are going to happen. And so they hop from one point to another depending on who they're talking to. So and Barry's implying that because you seek new images and put on new publics while hiding behind 19th century planks.
If I think of the word for hiding place in French is planque.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. To hide behind 19th century planks. Well, you mean spelled, how's it spelled? P-L-A-N-C?
P-L-A-N-Q-U-E.
Oh, Q-U-E, right. That's good. I wonder if Barry knew that. And remember, Barry is saying that though this is for people we've all had the experience of living mythically as disembodied spirits via media. We've already had the experience, so what is the meaning? Those who have not missed its meaning may now plunge through the looking glass like Alice to play yestermorrow in politics, economics, management. And he lays it out. That's his purpose here. And he calls it a Manipian global theater. I forgot. I've used that phrase and that idea for years. I didn't know he had actually said it. See, this is a global – that's the Android meme satirizing us. The media have extended themselves. They're not talking to us. They're satirizing us. So that's the Manipian global theater. That's incredible. I mean, I thought I came up with that. And then to come here and see that Barry has it, that's why you always have to go back and check the best. You always have to reread them because you'll find things that you didn't notice before. That's good art, and you find stuff you didn't notice. That's incredible. He's got Manipian global theater there. Created by the instant replay technologies. That's what I'm trying to say, that there's no now. There's a satirical effort to present a now more geared to you, you know, what you were saying about what the kids are being provided. Their world, this is your world, and it's all about you. That's a Manipian action, and that's what the kids don't understand. And I don't know how many could understand that.
My point. No, this is very, very interesting. Anyway, I am now developing the notion of Jesuit 2.0. Did I tell you about that?
Yes, yeah, you did in Nice, but you can say it again.
That's about education. It's about education. I'm going to present it to at least one of the top counselors of the Pope next week, so I'm really working on it.
Yeah, what did you say?
The Pope is a Jesuit, you know.
New grammar? What was it you said it was?
No, it was a simple concept that the Jesuits, actually Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit order, was just one among many founders of religious orders, but his purpose and his statement of purpose was to develop the missions, which all the religious orders were supposed to do. Some of them were contemplative. They didn't have to go out and do things. But anyway, this one was develop the missions was one thing, and then to develop an educational format, a real pedagogy for to train the future people, the future persons responsible for the public good, and trained them in a religious Catholic way, I suppose, as well, had developed this formidable, almost military mode of training kids, but including the very thing that all religious orders combined to hate, to abhor, which was theater. And because the Greeks had theater and the Jesuits, or Ignatius, had understood the value of theater to create a person. Put yourself on and suddenly you become somebody. And so what I'm saying about this is all based on the alphabet and on the renaissance of the Greek or Greco-Roman culture. This is all normal. Normal in the sense that the content of the cultural biases of that period were borrowed for a good reason from the very time, depending on the alphabet and on the creation of individuals. So there's a Jesuit come along and are the first religious or actually social order that that come up with a form, you know, a structured formal educational system. And so what I mean by Jesuit 2.0 is we need again somebody like Ignatius of Loyola who would not necessarily retake the old model, although the old model is still working and still used in most of the schools, but would create a completely new model of the relationship between children in the total environment, denuded in front of the total environment, ubiquitous. What is it, you know, how do you train kids today?
Well,
certainly not by repeating the old format.
Well, actually, I mean, I claim to, you know, I started a show to reach out to, quote, young people, and I call it What Youth. We point out that there's no such category anymore. And I point out last time that we need to make them warriors. And
that's right.
Not paranoid
what
warriors.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, comprehensive warriors.
Sorry, we did talk about it, but I just thought.
No, but I'm saying that I can see that we're developing it. I'm going to do a Ted Carpenter on you. There's a Kirchhoff ripped off all my ideas. So,
yeah,
but the point
that's
is,
really, really too bad. You know what?
No,
but I live in the present.
Listen,
I'm just whatever idea I can find, I'll just pocket it.
No,
okay,
listen,
man. I think
Derek,
we should just. I think we've got it.
No,
for
no,
the,
Derek.
For the
I
day.
Gotta say this. Just a minute. What we just described today, I think 18-year-olds would love to hear this stuff. I think they're ready for it. The most advanced thinking we just garbled and coming to the punchline of the Minipin Global Theater, that's what Jesuit 2.0 has to approach education with that level of expertise or perception or daring or panic, whatever you want to call it, all those things. I think that we've worked it out. I think these dialogues are part of the education that you're going to present.
Excellent. I'm very happy about that.
Yeah.
Even though you come with all sort of bad news, like there is no now and all these things, I still think it's worth doing.
A lot of the kids live that way. What about those Japanese kids? Remember a few years ago, they wouldn't leave their bedroom for 2 years or 3 years. You know, they didn't believe there was a now to engage. They need to have someone say this back to them because they're perceiving it. And they don't think the adults are even eligible to talk about it because the adults don't
get it. Why don't we leave the audience on this thought that came to my mind this week, or rather last week, when I had the visit of two Korean friends who came from Korea to discuss things. And I was, you know, marveling at the fact that now I could go to Google Translation and get English to Portuguese. I don't understand the first thing about Portuguese, but if all I have to do is throw my Portuguese text into the Google Translator, and I get an English text that actually is not only readable, but actually quite elegant.
Yeah.
So I decided that I was going to do a paper, which I had done in French, which I was quite proud of, and I wanted it to be done in English because I have friends who need it in English. So I did that, and instead of taking me 2 weeks of disasters, horrible time, I just hate translating myself, I did it in 3 days and taking my time to boot. And it came up very nicely in English, and I can send it to you. It's called Rereading Sartre in the Era of the Virtual, because Sartre has written a lot of stuff about the imaginary, and I wanted to know what would Sartre think about the virtual.
Right.
Anyway,
right.
So I did that. So I tell this to my Korean friends, and you know, I said, this is amazing. Now, how did they develop? Like, you know, there's so many contextual cues that these people need in order to understand exactly what I meant. He said, they don't give a hang about what you meant. I said, what? No, this has nothing to do with meaning. It has to do with text and context. What they have is an enormous database where all your originals and their potential translation are together. All they need to do is to match the sequence of words or letters or even signs. As far as the computer is concerned, they don't even know it's letters. It's zeros and ones. They all have to do is to just, you know, follow that sequence, match it to the nearest kind of possible match, and bingo, you've got a translation. And that's why, he said, instead of translating word for word, they give an adequate expression colloquialism to translate the expression colloquialism of the original language. And I think, okay, and my thought, my parting thought, as a parting shot is, what happens when we don't need meaning anymore?
I think that's another way of saying there's no now.
All right, you got the last word.
No, I'll have to think about it. Let's talk about that again. So how old were these Koreans?
No, one of them was there. Well, there was a couple, and she wrote a brilliant book, and I can send it to you about what it is to work in a digital environment and digital jobs and what it is that people don't understand in her own milieu of experts, so to speak.
Awesome.
So it's good. She uncovers a bunch of worms, really, but interesting. But her husband is a mathematician, computer scientist, and he follows these things very closely, and he was interested in, like myself, in the geometry of search engines, and so I just asked him, how is that happening? And then he left, and then I was back here thinking, well, what about face recognition? It's not merely ideographic. It simply is a matching system as well. So we have face recognition, and then I suddenly came back to the fact, for the first time, that a keyword is nothing but a sign. It has no meaning for the computer. And a keyword simply sends back to other keywords, but without ever going through meanings. We go through meanings. And it reminds me of, who was it, a famous, Ron Searle. I think it was Ronald Searle.
Yeah.
Who was it again? Austin Searle, or a guy who ended up at a conference where I was. And he said, words don't mean anything. People mean. And it's true.
Yes.
No, but the point is, we've always translated in our own mind. I speak three languages, right, or at least two and a half. And whenever I have to translate Italian or French, in fact, I don't translate anymore. I think in Italian, I think in French, or I think in English. But there was a time when I had to think in one language and translate it into another. When I started, balbutiating the second language. What I would do then is simply get the meaning of what the original language was and fetch that meaning in my memory in the second language. But this is not the case at all. Computers don't work like that, and we're under the fallacy where it's just as much of a fallacy as the fallacy of the reality fallacy of a photograph or a film. It's a complete fallacy. There's no meaning at all in the automated translation, and I found that quite a revelation. That's what I'm saying. Do we have to do with meaning at all anytime?
Yeah, that means we're in the interplay of senses. There's no sense. There's only the interplay, and that's tactility squared. The Android meme is tactility squared.
That's stylish. No, it's actually very. I am extremely interested in this right now, and so I'll tell you more next time.
Okay, that's very good. Very.
But
good.
But I
got to
run, Matt,
today.
Because it's time to eat. I'm starved.
Yeah. No. Fantastic discussion today. This is a good one to put out.
Okay.
Okay. Talk to you later,
right.
Eric.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.